Okay, good morning. Before we start our worship, I just wanted to say a few words to welcome you all to this fifth workshop on the philosophy of private law. I'm really glad to be here today to have this meeting face to face after 2 years. In 2020, this was supposed to happen in March, and a few days before the event, for obvious reasons, we had to cancel. First, we suspended for a few months, only for a few months, and then we canceled it. And last year, we decided to make a smaller event online. So this is resuming normality for us in this workshop, in this activity, and I'm really, really happy that we can be here sharing ideas together. History of this workshop is also something that I like to mention every time, and I will mention forever. As long as this workshop is held, I'm going to mention the origins, because it's a nice idea. It began as an informal meeting with our students in the Master of Tort Law. It was a non-mandatory activity in which two of our PhD researchers, students at the time and now currently professors of law in their home countries, wanted to present their ideas, discuss them with the people from the Master in Tort Law. So we organized this meeting, and almost everyone in the master's degree came, and we spent like 4 hours discussing about tort law and contract law, these PhD dissertations, and we had a great time. It was so good that we decided to make it official. And we said, okay, from now on, we're going to make it like an official activity of the Cátedra of the Chairing Legal Culture, like Cátedra de Cultura Jurídica. So this is the fifth, but the activity actually started in 2016, 7 years ago. It's a short history, but it's already a history. I don't want to say much more than this. Just to welcome you and to thank all the speakers for being here today. Today, I'm really glad we have four fantastic speakers. In the order they will present their papers, we have Professor Veronica Rodriguez Blanco from Surrey University and Vienna University. Then we have Professor Sandy Steele from University of Oxford. Then we have Professor Magdalena Bustos Díaz from the University of Chile. And finally, we have Claudio Michelon. Sandy and Claudio, for the first time, and hopefully not the last, in Girona. Claudio Michelon from the University of Edinburgh. These are people whose work I admire a lot. I think they're very interesting, what they present their ideas, and I think we will have a great time with discussing with them. Thank you again, and now I invite Carolina, who is the chairperson for this first presentation, to join me here in the table. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for being here. Thank you, Veronica, for being here and for your presentation. And the title of the work that Veronica is presenting today is The Abstract Challenge in Tort Legal Theory, Negligence and Practical Reason. And it's your time. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Diego, and to the organizers. It's lovely to be here with friends, new friends and colleagues. As always, I feel like to be in Girona is like to be home again. So today I have distributed a chapter 7 of my book on the responsibility for negligence in ethics and law. So one of the puzzles, and I'm going to stand up because it's going to be easier. I hope it's recording. Yes, so one of the puzzles that I aim to solve through the book is the question of what exactly a negligent act is. So I'm going to engage with moral and philosophical and legal theoretical ideas on the nature of what a negligent act is. And I think I'm going to explain why I think this is important. So I'm going to give a little bit of motivation and context of the chapter, but then discuss one key idea of the chapter, and I would love to receive feedback to see how these ideas are, we can shape them together. So we see that there is pressure from the side of not only law and economics, but from the philosophical side on the idea that we are responsible for our negligent act. And I'm going to give a general picture, a general diagnosis of where this pressure comes. So for example, as we know, the comprehensive legal system in New Zealand, they don't have actual responsibility for negligence. And many authors in legal theory and lawyers think because it's very random, arbitrary, how we actually have responsibility for negligence, then therefore we ought to get rid of tort law, and then specifically law of negligence. We see also pressure on the side of law and economics. They think that actually it is about justice in negligent law. I'm going to focus only on negligent law. It's about maximization of wealth. It's about effectiveness. And therefore, because of problems related to moral luck, which I'm going to explain as well a little bit today, then we need to get rid of that so-called negligence law. And then we are going to look, that maybe you are less familiar from the point of view of the philosophical pressure that we are receiving, the tension that exists on the possibility of responsibility for a negligent act. So I'm going today to explain this skepticism that arises within philosophy about responsibility for a negligent act. Then I'm going to explain where I think are the problems on understanding responsibility for a negligent act. Then I'm going to give my solution of what a negligent act is, and then, given this framework, explain what I think in theory, more specifically on corrective justice theories, the problem that I call the abstract challenge in relation to my picture of what a negligent act is. So the most famous skepticism is advanced by Rosen and Zimmermann in different articles, early Zimmermann and then Rosen in the 1990s. So they argue that we can't be responsible for our negligent act because we are not in control. Therefore, we have no knowledge of what we are doing. Remember, when we are negligent, we are distracted. We actually couldn't foresee the consequences of our act. We just forget to do something. And then therefore, the law attributes responsibility, and sometimes in our normal moral practices, we attribute to others responsibility for this act. So they argue that this is not possible because how can we be responsible when we are ignorant of characteristics, particularities of the act, and that even if we were responsible and were able to trace the act to a point at which we intentionally act, we will discover that either we have an infinite regress, because then we can ask at what point actually we were aware, or we have what is called an acratic act, or a witness of the will act. So let me explain what is a clear acratic act. A clear acratic act means that you knew you ought not to do the act, and in spite of that, you did the act, right? So the regresses stop because you have a clear acratic act. And so therefore, in a way, negligence collapses into an intentional action or a reckless action. So that's the puzzle. The puzzle is there is no responsibility because there is no control. How can you be responsible for something you have no control, you have no intention, you have no knowledge, even if we follow what's called, in technical terms, the tracing strategy, the only way to stop and regress is what is called the acratic act. Some legal theories have actually picked up, and they're coming actually from philosophy of criminal law. And we know that there are very early, I mean, an example is McCormick's beautiful papers, Obligations for Reparation. He clearly establishes the distinction between punishment and responsibility in the civil law. And he says, well, it's about compensation. And we will study a little bit more about that, the relationship between primary duty and secondary duty, with Claudio's paper. But here, first, person Alexander in the famous book on culpability, and Herder Moore in a famous paper, they argue that actually, because we cannot punish, and they see compensation as a punishment, we cannot punish someone because they are awkward, they are clumsy, they are forgetful, they are lazy. And typical examples, Alexander gave an example of a baby that is forgotten by the parents in the bathtub and drowned. Are they responsible? And they argue no, because if they knew and could foresee, they had control of the action, and therefore it collapses in recklessness or intentional action. So it's similar, but the discussion is more within the context of tort American law. So this is the picture, and this is the challenge. And I think this is at the bottom of the challenge as well of moral luck. So let me remind you, what is the challenge of moral luck? So moral luck was introduced in a debate between Thomas Nagel and Bernard Williams that actually give title to the essay Moral Luck, and also later his book Moral Luck. So the argument is this. Nagel argues in a Kantian way that you are only responsible for what you can control. So therefore, when you have knowledge of, or intention, or volition on your action, you have control on your action. And anything that happens beyond your body, beyond your sphere of knowledge, namely unforeseeable or foreseeable consequences of an act that you could not foresee, or you did not actually foresee, then you are not responsible for that. And then Bernard Williams gives the example of Gauguin the painter. He argues that there is a diachronic sphere, a dimension of agency. That at the moment when Gauguin decided to leave his family and go to Haiti, he became a painter, he didn't know he would become so successful. So he calls that intrinsic luck. So the world made his action meritorious, and in a way merit and demerits or credits or debits of our lives depend on contingencies and factors beyond our control. And that was taken up by Jeremy Waldron and in his article published in an edited collation on the foundations of tort law. And he argues, he puts the example of fortune and fate. Two drivers, and we know all that, you know, from textbook, two drivers who actually commit exactly the same fault. However, one runs over a child and the other is lucky. So he claims, we show here, we see the tension again, the question of the negligent act does not actually satisfy what is we call the fair and the good conditions of responsibility. And then the problem arises, I think, and this is the key argument of the book, is because we don't understand what negligent action really is. So all these, and I argue, I'm going to say here in a rhetorical way, and it shouldn't be taken with a pinch of salt, these are very trivial and mistaken conceptions of action, and in a way naive conceptions of action. In the discussion between Nagel and Williams, we see a caricature, an opposition between control and things beyond our control. And a little bit, I think, legal theory has become the work of Honoré on that, on outcome responsibility, very quickly, very superficially, without careful analysis of what exactly a negligent act is. And not surprisingly, because I think the key of the answer is given by Rosen and Zimmermann, when they said you need an acratic act. But when you look at the literature of the acratic act, I've been immersed in the last 6 years, it is complete mess. He claims, Rosen, and I think rightly, no one understands what an acratic act is. So, and my claim is that underpinning the structure of a negligent act, we have an acratic act. But we need to understand the distinction between a clear akrasia and non-clear akrasia. So I'm going to give a kind of a crash course on what is this notion of akrasia. So I start with the distinction, and please let me know if you get lost a little bit in this explanation. So with the distinction, we know when we act, there are beliefs involved and there are desires. So let me give you the most basic conception of an action. So I have the end, a trivial end, for example, of drinking a glass of water. And I actually get my money from my pocket, go downstairs, go to the shopping, to the grocery store and buy a glass of water. So my desire of drinking a glass of water and my belief that taking the money, going to the store, buying a glass of water will satisfy my desire. So here we have, in a basic conception, the interlink between desires and beliefs. So that's what an action is. An action is explained in terms of a pair, desires and beliefs. The problem is that the problem is going to be what is exactly a belief and a desire and how they interact. And here we have a bunch of theories of action. So we have, for example, Hume's theory of action. He thinks that we are attracted by desires, and then the only role of beliefs is to determine the means for these desires. So I decide to drink a glass of water. This desire is there to drink a glass of water, appears in my body, and then the only role or the cognitive aspect of myself, my beliefs, is to determine how I'm going to get a glass of water to satisfy my thirst. So that's the general human idea in a very broad conception. So we have means, beliefs related to desires. The problem with this view is that what generated, and that's a key argument of the book, is that it generates a bifurcation. Two sides. On the one hand you have desires, and on the other side we have beliefs. So for example, you have the externalist that claiming that it's a matter of deciding what is the correct belief. So theories of rationality that concentrate on the so-called what is the correct belief. So the correct belief would guide me in the so-called reasons for actions. And I avoid the word reasons for actions because here I think, I will explain that maybe later with the debate, the notion of reasons for action disguise the problem of the relation between beliefs and desires. Other views, for example, Williams' internalism, he thinks that it's all about desires. But there are desires more sophisticated, and then they could manifest externally. But the question is going to be how you connect your, what he calls the basic motivational set, your basic desires. Now, interestingly, I argue that all these theories establish a clear distinction between beliefs and desires, how we get our desires from beliefs, or whether there is a conflict of beliefs, or whether there is a conflict of desires. And all these theories of rationality, including hard choice, presuppose this bifurcation. Interestingly, when you look at the classical tradition, more specifically Aristotle, the key problem for both Plato, Socrates, and Aristotle, the question is how beliefs are related to desires. That is the question of action. And most importantly, I concentrate on the concept of deliberation. And nowadays we call the concept of rational decision. This concept of deliberation, for Aristotle, is very interesting because it's about settling the question, what I shall do. Of course, it includes drinking the water, but it also includes a small scale, medium scale, and large scale plans and goals and objectives. Interestingly, contrary to many interpretations of Aristotelian eco-making ethic, many people think that we have objective goods. For example, Cooper is one interpreter, Hardy, that claims that Aristotle is saying that there is the objective good, finished famously, there are objective goods, either therefore we need the determination and specification of what is the content of these objective goods. So therefore, when I determine what I shall do, I only need to determine the content of these ends. And I argue that this is a mistaken interpretation. I take all the readings of Aristotelian commentators and argue that it's more a complete indeterminate concept, the concept of eudaimonia or well-being. Living well, we don't know how it looks like. And it's through life that you are starting to give a picture of what living well is. And it's through a process of deliberation, engaging with specific values. And the way you engage with specific values has an element of craft and has an element of theory. Has an element, it's like a craft because you are actually determining what is the value of the thing through the things you do. When you play the piano, you are either engaging in the beauty of music, harmony, friendship, and so on, developing yourself, and that is discovering the value and giving content to the placeholder living well. And then you also, interestingly, has a process that is a theoretical reasoning, because you need to determine what are the basic elements of your action in order to act. And I claim that this is a so-called substantive deliberation, or narrow deliberation, for medium and medium scale goals and short-term goals. But also, we immerse in large goals, for example, you know, becoming a good partner, having children, having a good career, becoming a lawyer, and all these is done through what I call aspirational deliberation, in which you drag the basic values that you engage at the immersive level, and you drag them in an aspiring way, actually through others. So the bit of that book, I'm going to omit it because it's a little bit complex. So what happens with a kratic act? An acratic act is when you act in a way you have deliberated, you have settled what you ought to do, and in spite of that, you don't do it. So an example of the parents, for example, they forgot the child in the bathroom. They knew, they deliberated, they in the action, a friend rings at, let's suppose a friend rings in their apartment at the door. They, at the moment, there is a rush, they go downstairs, 5-6 minutes pass, they take the bottle of wine from their guest, they hug them, they talk, and then the child, when they go back, is drowned. So my argument is that they fail to inhabit the aspirational perspective. And what happened is that there is an uneven development between character, between desires, passions, and their cognitive abilities. And this is exactly what an acratic act is. It's interesting because I also engage with all the theories, for example, Douglas Hasek and many others, who think that there is an implicit belief, an unconscious belief, and this is what is wrong with a negligent act. And I argue against it because my what I'm trying to defend is a point of view of agency when we are immersed in a world of values, trying to engage with different values, and that we need, in a way, to align our beliefs and our desires. When we align our beliefs and in our desires in a way, we start to inhabit the aspirational point of view. And what I'm trying to argue is that actually what Lou does is that it presents to you a forward-looking thinking, inviting you to what is called proleptic blade, inviting you to inhabit the aspirational point of view. It's telling you, as an employer, you actually, of a chemical factory, you need to take all these measures because there are these different values, safety and so on. So in a way, tort law, and specifically negligent law, has a character that is proleptic, forward-looking, inviting the citizen to inhabit an aspirational point of view. And in a way, what I'm arguing is that underneath all this structure of rights and duties, there is a structure of the self that is immersed in values and in aspirations and avoidance of recognition of aspirational point of view. So it's not that there is a belief that is implicit, because this is a very theoretical conception of action, a very naive conception of action. There's a thing, we are already in values, you inherited values. You're just trying to work out what is the character of those values. In a way, that's why now you might discover I'm not using the word reasons for actions, because I'm arguing that, well, in a way, reasons for action are distracting us for exactly the way we engage with value. So it's not because you have certain beliefs or misbeliefs or confusion, it's because actually you are discovering how to engage with values from the point of view of your desires and emotions, and the way from your intellectual capacity. In a way, I argue as well that reasoning changes our desires.
one, our desires change, the desires also transform our beliefs. So there is a complete interaction between desires and beliefs. And this is kind of a very, very fast track. How long do we have, Steve?
We have 15 minutes, but we started a little bit later, so.
Okay, brilliant. So this is a very fast track on what is 3-4 chapters of the book. So let me go now about legal theory. Yes? But this has nothing to do with the law, right? Law is a right and duties, and this is the kind of, you know, negligent law we are trying to defend. So let us see what the law tells us. So the law tells us there is a duty of care and imposes on us, in the English law, what is called the idea of the reasonable person, right? And some people think that actually we need rules and directives to determine what the reasonable person is. And my argument is that if we understand what negligent action is, and if I'm right, we are ourselves immersed in values, who are trying to align desires and beliefs and understanding values, in a way the law, the legislator, and the judges are trying to shape the form of the so-called reasonable person in the particular circumstances. So that's the key of the aspect. Now, it seems that the abstract idea of the idea of the duty of care has no content in terms of guidance and practical reason. Can we have a mandatory norm with no content? So that's the challenge. And it's going to take a better shape when we discuss corrective justice. So when we understand what is the role of corrective justice in relation to my conception of the self, we're going to understand how the what I call the abstract challenge can be solved. So let me now go to the second bit. What is this Weinreich corrective justice theory, which I think is one of the most powerful? It's interesting because we forget that there are two stages in this theory. One is the Aristotelian conception of corrective justice, what is called the arithmetic asymmetry. He claims that when I do a wrong to you, there is a subtraction and there is a gain. There is a loss and there is a gain. And then it is arithmetic because there is a plus and there is a minus. But he thinks this is a description and doesn't give us any normative grounding of why I ought to pay compensations. And we will see this in the discussion of Claudio. Now, in order to rescue the Aristotelian idea of corrective justice, which he thinks is merely descriptive, and this is part of the debate about the Aristotelians, he's going to resort to the Kantian thesis of rights and duties that he thinks it provides the ultimate in structure of foundation of the doctrinal aspect of the so-called duty of care, breach of a duty of care, a standard of care. And then, obligation, a duty to pay. So now, interesting. So let me explain a little bit what is this Kantian, remember, it's about external freedom. So if I have two bottles and they clash, it doesn't really matter, right? There's no minus, no plus. There's no normative aspect. There's no justificatory aspect. The problem is when two rational beings, I'm going to introduce a nominal self because this is going to be important. Two persons clash, there's a rational process here. And there is, in a way, you are not legitimately taking the other people's space unless you take him as equal and with and equal respect, right? So the idea is that when two rational beings clash, it's not permissible unless your freedom is authorizing and is to the same extent to the other's freedom. So that's the idea. Choice, will, deliberation, everything that I have explained you, aims, goals, are irrelevant here. Because it is all about external freedom. It's the clash of two rational beings putting in the normative process in the same position. It's not two bottles, it's not two objects, but two rational beings. That both, we presuppose, this word is important, that both are free and they both have to respect each other to have the equal extension of each other's freedom, right? And then in the doctrine of right, Kant says, then if there is an abuse of this rational equality, the state can authorize coercion. Yeah? We are authorized to exercise coercion. That's it. That's Kant. Yeah? And we will see that the struggle of this picture in Claudius' paper. Because now the question is, by the way, compensation appears here. In Kant, it's all about external freedom. Free will, choice, ends, rational, that is irrelevant because two rational beings have clashed and then coercion is authorized. But Kant doesn't say what kind of coercion we can exercise to correct the inequality of these two rational beings. So then they add, obviously, some more flesh to this. He says, it is an internal process, and this is hard to understand for someone who is not a Kantian. It's internal, it's not the internal external point of view of Kant, no. It's internal because it's through thought, it's through a rational thought. And then we come, when two bodies clash, there's no thought. But when two human beings clash, we think it's illegitimate because it's from our normative thought, from our idea of reason. We don't see the flesh of Diego in contact with my flesh. We see Diego as a person, Veronica as a person, Diego's rights in conflict with my rights. And this is the normative thought. That's why it's internal. It's immanent because it generates all thinking. I said, you have a right and I have a duty. You have to respect my right, I said to Diego, if Diego actually runs into me, right? And that is immanent because it generates its own thinking from, and this is something they do, Bindred and both Richter, I'm not going to explain Richter here, Bindred says it is from the internal immanent legal thinking, and that's why it has a form, the form of the legal thinking. And then we have as a magic from the hat, the rabbit, we have the categories of the doctrinal thinking. They think this is the ground of the so-called duty of Genzo. Okay, so now we go to the abstract challenge. What is the problem? And they are aware this is an abstract. So I have invited you to a thinking that is completely different. I say the law invites the employer, owner of a chemical weapons, or, sorry, of a chemical, so sorry, chemical factory, is a the chemical factory to actually wear helmets for his employees and take safety measures, is inviting the employer not to breach his duty, to have a duty of care, to engage with the values that the law has set up for them. Now, the problem is that guidance in terms of abstract right and duty, nominal says, doesn't say anything to the employer. The only way the employer is going to engage is from the forward-looking perspective. Engaging in deliberation when he asks, what shall I do? Shall I obey this statute, this directive from the European directive, and so on and so on. Now, they are aware that abstract duty needs to have particularity to have guidance. They are aware of that, and I quote in the chapter some bits where both Weinrib and Richten allege to that. However, this is not how our thinking is. If I'm right on the way we deliberate, our deliberation is in terms of values, it's not in terms of abstract duty and. So I'm not claiming that abstract duty and abstract right cannot come down to value and that we need particularity. I'm claiming that this is not the form of our deliberation at all. Principles, rules, and so on appear at the point of attribution. So what we do is we have these categories, rights and duties, and they are a useful tool for the judge to attribute responsibility, not ex ante, post the event. So that's the argument. And I say that they can't actually explain, and I'm not the only one who has said that, Keating, for example, has said, the problem with corrective justice is that they can't give a forward-looking picture of tort law, which is, I think, half of the job of tort law, because we would say that tort law invites, negligence law, invites the citizen to occupy an aspirational point of view, and they can't give an explanation. So, what I'm saying is this, at the point of view of attribution, the corrective justice works, and we still have to solve the problem of compensation, as we will learn at the end of the day today. But we say the guidance problem is given by engagement with values, by process of deliberation, by avoiding a cratic act, and not the guidance is not provided by duty and by right, because this is just an attributive function, has an attributive function. And you see the two roles, forward-looking and backward-looking. So the law of negligence has these two aspects, and if we don't understand how they interact, we're missing what tool law is, specifically the law of negligence. Well, thank you for your patience. And there are some objections. I don't know if I have the time to argue on the objections, but I mean, probably will come later. I think, yes.
If you need more time, you have.
No, that's all right. Thank you. I think I look forward to listening to what people say, think about this.
Thank you very much.